welcome to Asian American Perspectives. I'm Eric Olander. In this edition of Perspectives, American views on human rights in China. Every country, every society has a unique definition of what constitutes a human right. The dispute lies in whether civil, political, and social rights are inalienable rights. Jack Rendler of Amnesty International explains.
Well, a civil right is a subcategory of human rights, I think, in most people's minds. The exact content of a human right is much debated. The law and the common understanding internationally that go toward defining human rights is still a process. It's still emerging. But I think that most people would agree that human rights is composed both of civil and political rights. That is, your freedom to speak out, your freedom to hold certain political or religious beliefs, your freedom to assembly, freedom to express your opinion, and some economic rights, your freedom to hold a job, to form a union, to not be prevented from gainful employment by the government.
So a human right represents an umbrella right. Every other right falls under a human right.
That's correct. Human rights are the broad category. Civil and political rights would be one category under that. Economic, social, cultural rights would be other categories under human right. And the area that Amnesty is concerned with, what we think of or what we act upon as basic human rights, is your right not to be imprisoned for your beliefs, your right not to be tortured, your right not to be killed by your government.
Despite the differences, the United Nations has developed a fundamental standard which is put forth in various treaties, including the International Bill of Rights and the UN Declaration of Rights in Man. China for years has had a very poor record, as exemplified by the Cultural Revolution, their crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators on Tiananmen Square in June of 1989, and the subsequent show trials in the winter of 1991. Once again, Jack Rendler.
Well, Amnesty has had concerns in China virtually since we were founded in the early 60s. They have included the large-scale arrests of dissidents, sometimes under the guise of crime prevention sweeps, the mistreatment of petty criminals in custody, including bad prison conditions, beating, torture. The execution of both political dissidents and many varieties of criminals over the years, including both petty criminals and people convicted of serious crimes such as rape and murder. Many of those executions have been carried out in public, and many of them have been carried out in a very hasty way. There's not much of an appeal process in China. Sometimes people are executed within 24 hours of having been convicted for a capital offense. When you go into a Chinese courtroom, the presumption is that you are guilty, and it is up to you to establish your innocence. That is bad enough, but the government stacks the deck against you by not allowing you to have a lawyer of your choice, not allowing defendants to meet with their attorneys, putting all the resources at the state's disposal into the prosecution and none for the defense. So our concerns have really run the gamut of Amnesty's concerns. We've been concerned about political imprisonment. We've been concerned about treatment in custody and torture, and we've been concerned about killings, both in the streets and executions.
Over the past, say, 2 to 3 decades, what have been the trends of human rights violations in China?
Well, you've seen I don't know if there's one constant trend. There have certainly been waves. There have been periods where there has been a relaxation, as I'm sure you know, of freedom of expression. People were able to, in the late 60s, able to express their opinions fairly openly, and then again in the mid-80s. But that was always followed by a very severe crackdown. The Cultural Revolution, the various anti-crime measures that have resulted in tens of thousands of arrests. So I think what you see is reflected on the street and in the prisons, the struggle for power at the top of the Chinese governmental establishment. Some people want to loosen up the rules, and when that happens, people express themselves. They begin to get enthusiastic about human rights or democracy, and they take advantage of what they think are signals of liberalization. Then a crackdown inevitably ensues, and those people who took their cues from the leadership that they could express their opinions more freely wind up being detained or tortured or killed. And I think that back and forth has been more characteristic of the People's Republic of China than any long-term trend. I would say since Tiananmen Square, we have seen more responsiveness on the part of the Chinese government in some ways. After the events, the arrests and the killings that occurred throughout China in response to demonstrations around the time of the Tiananmen Square occupation, there were far fewer executions than there might have been at a previous time. There were a lot of arrests, certainly, but many of those people were released. Many of them got prison terms of between 7 and 13 years. Now, 13 years is a very long time for simply for speaking your mind or taking part in a peaceful demonstration. But it's not as long as some previous sentences for similar offenses. And certainly there were fewer executions carried out as a result of people being charged in association with those demonstrations.
Author-journalist Orville Schell is one of America's most renowned Sinologists. Schell has covered China for The New York Times, The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, as well as other magazines and newspapers. Schell is also the author of numerous books, including To Get Rich is Glorious, China in the 1980s, and Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. Schell says the concept of human rights which we expect in the West is not the same as in China.
China is not a very fertile ground for human rights in the sense that we understand them in the West, namely rights that people are born with. The conception of rights in China is more that they are rights that a government may or may not choose to invest its people with. And in China, the government tends to invest its people with less rather than more of these rights. To date, they've been more eager to allow sort of economic rights, more free enterprise than political rights, freedom of expression, speech, assembly, religion, etc. So I think it's been a very difficult course, traditionally speaking, and equally as difficult after 1989, when the government had a tremendous contraction of its notion of how much freedom it should allow its people to enjoy.
How much does the government, the Chinese government, manipulate human rights for political purposes?
Well, the Chinese government's extremely sensitive to the way in which they are perceived by the outside world, which of course imbues the outside world with a certain power, or at least influence, over them. So they're they watch very keenly what we here have to say and how closely we watch what goes on there. I think if left to their own devices, there would be infinitely less human rights allowed than there is with the world opinion kind of peering over their shoulder.
Article 35 of the Chinese Constitution grants certain freedoms that we all take for granted here in the West, yet Article 51 kind of, you know, denounces those rights. Therefore, what's the purpose of Article 35?
Well, Article 35 in the Chinese Constitution guarantees people the basic rights of freedom of expression. But as And I think the reason why that article is there is, once again, because the Chinese government is very sensitive to how things appear to the outside world. So they want to give at least the appearance that there is freedom. But there are also provisions for national security, ones similar to the ones we have, in fact, in this country, but they're much more rigorously administered in China, which say, in effect, that anything anyone does that jeopardizes the security of the country is unconstitutional. And this opens, of course, the grounds for them to view people's political expressions as being counter-revolutionary, or their actions. And this is the main lever that the government has, in spite of their constitution, to clamp down on people's rights of assembly or freedom of speech or press.
What is the role of courts in China today?
Well, it's curious. I mean, China has revived its a legal system, and they have criminal code, commercial code, and various other codes. And there is a revived court system after the Cultural Revolution, when the courts basically died as a piece of the governmental infrastructure. But they are, even though there are laws and there are ways to appeal things and there are various, you know, legal procedures that should be followed through, all of these can be overridden by political considerations or by the desires, the needs of the party and its leaders. So it's a curious situation where you do have the development of a legal system. And a lot of people in China believe this is the only salvation of the country. In other words, a country that operates according to certain set prescriptions of behavior. On the other hand, you have these old-time leaders in the party, which whenever they wish, just ignore this legal structure, the courts, and the legal system of codes, and they do basically what they want. So it's a kind of a contradiction at work.
So why would they have trials if the political machine can essentially convict someone without a court?
Well, the reason why they have trials is partially because, again, there is a concern for how they will be perceived in the outside world. And also because for many cases, you know, criminal cases, the legal system will work to some degree. You know, if there's a robbery or a rape or a murder, this is fine because this is not a political question. Where the courts begin to bog down is where there are so-called crimes with political significance, such as the people who organized spring of 1989 and the democracy demonstrations. And of course, there is also a whole other extrajudicial system of punishment called reform through labor, where people can be just taken off the streets and put into these laogaidui, these reform through labor camps, with no judicial procedure whatsoever. It's administrative incarceration. So China is a kind of a caught in between. I mean, it's trying to develop a legal system because there is a reform faction that believes that only with such a system can China deport itself in a rational way, both within the world and at home. But it is also constantly being overridden by the demands of politics as the party and its leaders perceive it.
Would you say the latest round of pro-democracy trials, where some of the most severe sentences were handed down, were superficial political trials, or were they actual judicial trials?
Well, I think most of these recent trials were fairly superficial if you depart from the notion that a counter-revolutionary offense is absurd to begin with. I mean, who decides what's counter-revolutionary? It's utterly and totally arbitrary.
Doesn't Section 102 of the Constitution decide what's counter-revolutionary?
Well, it sort of tries to. Anybody who opposes the state, anybody who opposes the Communist Party, the dictatorship of the proletariat, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, if you're going to base a trial on the notion of someone having committed counter-revolutionary acts that are sort of patently unconstitutional anyway, the whole thing is a farce from beginning to end. But I think what's interesting about the recent trials is that you actually saw some people getting off free. And some got long sentences, 13 years, but not as long as they might have gotten before. And again, I think this is because world opinion has watched relatively closely and has impinged on the government's ability to slam its detractors and its dissidents as hard as it would like to with sentences that could put them away for much longer.
Stanley Rosen is a professor of Chinese political science at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. I spoke with Professor Rosen about the pro-democracy trials which took place this past winter. Is it possible, though, that some people are suggesting that there was a deal made between Bush and the Chinese, a tacit deal nonetheless, in exchange for China's tacit support on this on the UN Security Council, Bush and the administration would turn a blind eye to these trials, which they seem to have done? Is that feasible?
I think it's feasible. Tacit deals of that type don't even have to be necessarily discussed directly. I think the Chinese were probably led to believe that the U.S. would not make a major, at least the U.S. government would not make a major point about the Chinese trials unless, for example, there were executions or the Chinese acted in some way which forced the Americans to say something. And I think the Chinese look upon these trials, at least in their own mind, the Chinese leadership, as have themselves being relatively lenient.
How calculated is the timing of these trials with regard to America's involvement in the Middle East and the Soviet Union's own domestic problems?
Well, as I mentioned before, I think there is some relationship that the cases could have been prepared earlier, and it's a very convenient time to get it all out of the way during the Gulf War. And of course, the Chinese have known the deadline of January 15th and the possibility of armed action in the Gulf. So I think certainly it would be surprising if they did not take that into account in deciding when to hold the trials.
As far as you know, what has been the American reaction to these trials?
Well, the reaction has varied depending on how much people know and care about China. If you look at American academics who study China, people like Merle Goldman, they've written articles in the New York Review of Books, and people like Orville Schell, of course, have talked about it, and obviously Chinese like Fang Lijie have gone around speaking against it. But for the general public in the United States, it certainly is not a crucial issue. It's a secondary issue. What was important to the general American public was seeing what happened in Tiananmen Square because it was televised. What's going on now is of really secondary, if not completely unimportant, interest compared to what's going on in the Middle East.
Do you think Americans have forgotten Tiananmen Square?
I don't think they've forgotten it, especially younger people. I see students all the time. That's what they remember about China. There's a sort of image of China which has changed. I don't think they've forgotten Tiananmen Square, but they certainly, the attention span is very limited for people in the United States. And Tiananmen Square has happened. It's over. This is what we think of the Chinese government. It's bad. But beyond that, it doesn't translate into anything else except that fewer and fewer people are traveling to China on vacations or tourism and so on. And I think that's the long-term effect.
Why is it that American presidents seem to consistently overlook China's poor human rights record?
Well, Bush's argument is that China is different from other countries. I don't particularly buy that. Of course, it's different. Every country is different. There is a feeling, I think, within the administration that we have, as I say, we have very limited influence on a country like China, which has a history of Western impact and being exploited by the West, and will react very negatively if it's seen that there's an attempt to somehow limit their sovereignty. There's that, in some ways, an oversensitivity to the feelings of the Chinese government. One can say it's partly racist in that we consider that the Chinese are not part of the European system, and so human rights are not as important there. It goes back to something like a yellow horde mentality that the Chinese can suffer much longer than Americans can. Sort of the same thing Saddam Hussein is saying about the Iraqis. We can lose hundreds of thousands of people and it won't bother us, whereas you lose 10,000, it makes a big deal. We tend to buy that kind of an argument in cultures we don't know much about.
This has been Asian American Perspectives. I'm Eric Olander in San Francisco. Perspectives would like to thank Jack Rendler, Orville Schell, and Professor Stanley Rosen for their cooperation. Asian American Perspectives is a production of Echo Communications, all rights reserved.